People get ready, there's a train a-coming. Curtis Mayfield and the Impressions, 1965. Well, I want to welcome you to Unspun, an experiment in truth-telling. I am your host, Doug Bennett. Unspun tries to unravel the hype and the illusions of corporate media through in-depth interviews with truth-tellers, advocates, and activists from around the world. Unspun is a call-in show. We invite comments and questions on air. Unspun is now broadcast twice a week, starting this last week, Saturdays, of course, 9 a.m. now, and for you late sleepers, Wednesday at 4 p.m., right before the Tom Hartman Show. We are very fortunate today to have as our guest, Robert W. McChesney is the Gutskill Endowed Professor at the in the Department of Communications at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, and the author of 23 books, author or editor, I should say, of 23 books. His work has been translated into 30 languages. He is the co-founder of Free Press, a national media reform organization. In 2008, the Utney Reader listed McChesney among their 50 visionaries who are changing the world. His latest publication, co-authored with John Nichols, Washington, D.C. correspondent for The Nation magazine, is entitled People Get Ready, The Fight Against a Jobless Economy and a Citizenless Democracy. Wall Street on Parade praises the book, saying, quote, Generation Screwed gets a political organizing primer just in the nick of time. Naomi Klein says, quote, John Nichols and Robert McChesney make a compelling and terrifying case for a radical reform agenda to take power back from the corporations and give it to the people. Among his other publications are Digital Disconnect, How Capitalism is Turning the Internet Against Democracy, and Corporate Media and the Threat to Democracy. He is a longtime fighter for media reform and a chronicler of the demise of democracy in America. Well, let's welcome Robert McChesney. Robert McChesney, welcome to Unspun, an experiment in truth-telling.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, it's wonderful to have you. Your new book, I found it not only educational, but really a great read. Two things stand out in my mind. You have so much historical content that I think is valuable, and then you have a vision for where we can go to in the future. So maybe you'd like to maybe start there and talk about the book, and we'll go from there.
Sure, I'd be glad to. You know, John Nichols and I have written, I think this is our sixth book, and after we did our last book, Dollarocracy, we had plans to write another book, basically on ideas about democracy in the United States and worldwide and what's happening. And then about 2 years ago, something took place. Eric Schmidt, the CEO of Google, went to the Davos convening in Switzerland. And Davos is an annual convening of the wealthiest people in the world, leading political figures and financiers. So people like Bill Clinton hang out there, and Warren Buffett and Bill Gates. And, you know, so it's really the exclusive gathering of, for lack of a better term, the global ruling class. And at that meeting, Eric Schmidt gave one of the keynote addresses. And in the address, he said, here at Google, we're working on some technologies, some developments, along with other companies in the United States and worldwide, that will, in the next 20 or 30 years, eliminate a significant percentage, millions, tens of millions of jobs in the economy, due to robotics, artificial intelligence, and computer technology. And Eric Schmidt said to these assembled fellow members of the billionaire class and political leaders of the nations of the world, he said, these developments for the next 20 or 30 years will become the number one dominant political issue of our times. that every society's got to deal with massive unemployment and displacement of workers. And John and I saw that. We said, this is sort of interesting. Is this true? The first question I'd ask, is this actually happening? And if it does, what are the political implications of this, and what should we understand and do about it? Hence the title, People Get Ready. And so what John and I did is we actually read the literature in the business press, in the engineering press, in the scientific literature to see how realistic it was, these claims of Schmidt. And we also read the history of automation and technology in capitalist economies, and especially since computers came along in the 1940s, and how that would change labor practices. And to make a long story we go through in the book with a lot of history short, what we found out is that, in fact, Eric Schmidt was telling the truth. He was not blowing smoke at his fellow billionaires. Instead, he was telling them exactly what's coming so they could prepare for it and know what was about to hit them. We are on the cusp of revolutionary transformation of labor thanks to the extraordinary new developments in robotics and artificial intelligence, far beyond anything we've seen before, that will make it very lucrative, profitable, and rational for businesses to replace human labor with computers and machines, and what they will do in their pursuit of profit. So then that part we're pretty content. It's pretty clear that's happening. We go through that at some length in the book, the explanation for why that is and what that will mean. And we can talk a little bit about that later in the show if you'd like. But then the heart of the book, I think, is saying, okay, if that's the case, what does this mean politically? And our argument is that this is basically not an economic or technological problem, ultimately. It's a political problem. It's going to require a political solution. And the problem we face in the United States with the coming wave of underemployment and unemployment is that our political system is pretty much not functioning as anything remotely close to an effective democratic system or system that really puts much stock in the interest of the bulk of the population. This isn't really a controversial point. Our leading political scientists in the last 5 years from universities like Cal and Stanford and Princeton and University of Virginia and Michigan and Northwestern have combined in several independent studies of how decisions are made by the U.S. government. And they all independently come to the exact same conclusion, which will be no surprise to anyone who's paying attention, which is that in the United States today and for some time, all the decisions are made on behalf of the interests of those with great deals of money. And the concerns, values, beliefs of the rest of the population absolutely have no bearing on those decisions if they come into conflict with people with money at the top of the system. We're not at all, we're what we call in the title of the book, a citizenless democracy. So in the book, what we argue is that we have to rejuvenate, extend, and deepen our democracy dramatically. And that's the solution to this problem. If we do that, we argue the evidence is clear that we can take these technological revolutions that are going on, that are going to transform the economy and the workplace, and put them to the benefit of all humanity. You know, we could actually make a qualitatively superior world for all of us. But if we don't extend, deepen democracy, it could be a far gloomier world, and the revolution going on in technology could produce more unemployment. Sort of ultra-right-wing politics will emerge. Fascism is the term that's commonly used. And it also will lead to a situation where instead of liberating humanity, it will imprison them. So we're at a really interesting point in history, and that's what we try to suggest in the book and why we rely so much on history to get our bearings to the context that we talk about.
I failed to give our call-in number in the introduction. Let me do that right now. You're listening to Unspun, an Experiment in Truth-Telling. I'm your host, Doug Bennett. Our guest today, Robert W. Machese, co-founder of Free Press, author, and media reformer. We're discussing his latest book, People Get Ready, The Fight Against a Jobless Economy and a Citizenless Democracy. Our call-in number is 530-337-1885, 530-337-1885. Yeah, I think anybody that's really paying attention understands that we're at some at a point, an inflection point or whatever you want to call it in America, because we see this huge growing inequality and unemployment and poverty in America that we haven't seen since the 30s. And I don't want to spend a whole lot of time on the history, but you know, how we got here is important, and of course, you're projecting a different future now where this technology can serve us. And I remember when the internet first came online, and I was very big on it and promoting it, got involved, and thinking that it was the next level of democracy where we could actually have a real voice in the world. The potential for what you call the democratic infrastructure was so great with that, but it seems to all have gone awry.
So, you'd like me to comment on your comments?
Sure.
Okay. Well, let's see. Yeah, I think as far as the internet, it has great promise. It still has spectacular value. I don't want to diminish it, and I think we take for granted much of what it can do, but it's not a magic drug. And it also has great damage that it could do, too. And by internet, let's extend that to the broader digital revolution. We're in a society that offers access to much greater information for people and to do an end run around corporate media on one hand. But this technology also allows people in power to monitor us far closer than any population's ever been monitored in human history. So there's two sides of the same coin that come with this situation, and those are very important battles. One of the arguments you make about why the book goes so much into history is that if we don't really understand history at all, we're going to have a very difficult time knowing what our options are now and what's worked in the past and what hasn't, and understand just the extent of the sort of types of changes we're in. And, I think I want to just go back to laying the table here again, because I think that it sounds sort of extreme, the jobless economy, and that there's not going to be any work. And now that's crazy.
It seems paradoxical, actually. Jobless economy and citizenless democracy seems like a paradox that can't exist, actually.
Well, you're absolutely right. In fact, a jobless economy can't genuinely exist under capitalism, at least. And the reason is that you've got to, if you aren't people with incomes from labor to purchase things, then businesses have no reason to invest. And then you're just in depression. You don't get out of the depression you're in. And in fact, that is sort of economic climate we have right now. Even before this hits, there's right now $2 trillion in liquid capital cash that corporations in the United States are sitting on, but they're not investing. They're not investing because there's not enough people out there with cash to buy products, demanding products that can pay for them, so they have no incentive to put a lot of money into new investments when they can't return get a profit on it because they can't sell what they produce. So this would just greatly aggravate that already existing problem in capitalism. But the real reason we look at history, too, is that not only are we about to go... Well, let me finish that point. So to give some sense of just how spectacular the computer revolution on jobs is, there's an organization called DARPA, which is the Defense Advanced Research Program, out of the Pentagon. And its job for decades now has been to fund, guide, high-technology innovation and development and research. And it much of the internet was created and established by DARPA, the Pentagon really was central to its creation. For the last 10 or 12 years, DARPA has had a program on robotics and automation. It's been a high priority there to sort of work on this. And the head of that program, Bill Pratt, left DARPA last summer, and he wrote an article in a journal on what this group had come up with. And he said that the world and the United States is on the verge of a technological revolution in robotics and artificial intelligence. I mean, it's coming right soon. Stuff they're working on is actually working now. It just has to be made practical. That is simply almost beyond human comprehension, what it will be able to do. And perhaps the best way to understand what we're about to enter as a species on this planet is that we're about to hit what he called another Cambrian explosion. Now, I didn't know what that term meant exactly. I'd sort of heard it. I thought maybe it was an Arnold Schwarzenegger movie or something, Cambrian explosion. It sounded sort of cool. But I looked it up, and I found out the Cambrian explosion refers to that period 540 million years ago, when life on this planet went from being very simple, single-celled organisms mostly, that really hadn't changed a whole heck of a lot in the previous 500 million or billion years, to this explosion where all the diversity we have in the world today in life that we came along sort of was created and launched. About a 20 or 30 million year period, that was when dinosaurs and what eventually became mammals and all that was created. It was when living creatures could actually see, vision was developed, all sorts of things. And he said that's what humanity is about to hit, a Cambrian explosion. And that means that this is something so profound that's about to hit us, we almost can't fully understand what was going to be taking place. And one thing that Pratt said is the only thing we can say for certainty that it's going to happen soon and dramatically is that many, if not most, jobs will be eliminated because they're going to be able to be, human labor is going to be surpassed and replaced by computers and robotics and artificial intelligence. This will be much less expensive and far more efficient, and businesses will rationally turn to it. He said that's definitely coming. And so that got our attention, along with a lot of other studies that said basically the same thing. And what that means is, you know, we talk about things like driverless cars, which is really not even cutting-edge technology anymore. That technology is done. Now it's just a political battle to get humans from behind the wheel so they can let driverless cars take over. And you can make a pretty strong argument that driverless cars are actually, in a sane world, would be really good, because then you could have basically share-ride cars in cities. People wouldn't have to have their own cars. Be much more environmentally sound and friendly. There'd be no accidents. No one would die in traffic accidents anymore. People would be much more efficient. There's all sorts of great arguments for it. But in our economy, driverless cars will produce an extraordinary nightmare scenario for many working class and middle class Americans, because the number one job in the American economy for men is driving a vehicle, a truck, a bus, a limousine, a taxi, a delivery vehicle. That's the number one job, and there's nothing even close to it. There's not a number two or number three. There's only also receiving votes at the bottom of the page. And so if you wipe those off the board, all those commercial jobs that are driving vehicles, it's like losing the auto industry itself. I mean, that's like losing your major industry, just having it disappear. So that's the problem with capitalism. Capitalism can't really accommodate these technological revolutions. And this is not something that's just a new idea. This is the greatest economists who study capitalism have understood this. John Maynard Keynes, arguably the greatest economist of the 20th century, who wrote the general theory that provided the roadmap out of the Depression in the 1930s. Keynes wrote a prescient essay in 1930 called A Letter to My Grandchildren, where he said that capitalism today looks like it's weak. He wrote it at the depths of the Depression. He said, it looks like it's weak, but actually the problem with capitalism is too strong. It's producing more and more and more. It's much more efficient and productive than what it can successfully consume. And he said, this is not going to ever end. He said, 100 years from now, referring to the year 2030, we'll have enough productive capacity. Workers will be so productive with the new technologies that are coming that very few humans will have to work to provide all the sustenance everyone on Earth will need, or everyone in the country referring to Britain will need. And it's going to completely change the world, because the economic problems driven the human race since its inception, which has evolved out of the apes, surviving materially, will not be the pressing concern that guides all of life, the obsession with work and labor. We're going to have to create a whole new type of humanity, a whole new human nature, really. And it was a brilliant essay, but he got it. He understood it. It's John Stuart Mill, as did Karl Marx, that capitalism had its pluses and its minuses, but it was a revolutionary system built within it, where seeds owed its own destruction, that at some point it would be so advanced that the system would no longer work. It only worked when you had scarcity as the order of the day. And after that, it simply wasn't functioning. And that's the point we're approaching, we argue in the book, where we're going to have to rethink how the economy works altogether. The current system can't accommodate these technologies without turning them on us and making life much more brutal. Now, to get back to you, this is a long answer to your question, to your statement, but your statement had a lot packed into it. This is why we look at the 1930s so closely. We say, how do democratic societies in capitalist societies dealt with massive unemployment and underemployment in the past. And the great period to study that is the 1930s and 40s. That's the era in which, you know, the United States, Britain, Germany, France, the great powers, have huge levels of unemployment, 15, 20, 25, 30% real unemployment, and that usually underscores the actual unemployment dramatically. And you know, that in those situations, in almost all those countries, tremendous stress on the establishment, the governing systems, and it, generally speaking, many of them collapsed because their mainstream governments were not especially democratic, they were corrupt, they were incapable of solving the problems, these powerful interests weren't interested in solving them. And so it's interesting to look at that period in all the countries then to see how they responded to the massive unemployment, the Depression. And if I can generalize, there were two responses in the West. One was what's called social democracy, or what we call in the United States the New Deal, which was the idea that the government would aggressively work on behalf of working class people, middle class people, to take the money that wasn't being invested by rich people and either borrow it or tax it, throw it into the economy by public works and putting people to work building stuff, doing stuff. And then over time, as people got more jobs and wages went up because of this, they would start buying products and businesses would have an incentive to invest in them. There'd be a market for their products and businesses would invest. And over time, you get back to a full employment economy. You're close to it. And while you've done that, you've also enhanced democracy. You've reduced inequality. You've reduced poverty. It's a win-win across the board. But the catch there is for that to work, working class people have to be permitted and entitled to and take much more political power than had been the case in the past. The other side of the coin was in countries like Germany and Italy, where fascism became the order of the day. And the idea was to generate full employment. The solution was to get rid of democracy, and to really work closely with the wealthiest, most powerful giant corporations and investors in the company to produce full employment using militarism, government payments not for social services, not for benefits to the population, but rather for militaristic and police purposes to create employment and to sort of whip the country into sort of frenzied support of the maximum leader. And our argument at the beginning of this book, interesting, Doug, and I'll wrap on this point, was that as the United States enters this era that we're going into, like other countries in the world currently are going through, and Greece and Spain are the two most dramatic examples now in Europe, we should see the rise of, on one hand, democratic socialism as a phenomenon that will become much more popular, especially among young people who are in a depression labor market. And on the other side of the coin, we should see the return of fascism. And when we first wrote this in our introduction to our editor like 9 months ago, she got a copy of her 10 months ago, and she wrote back to us, she said, you can't put this in a book written for an American audience. No one's going to buy the argument that democratic socialism or fascism have any relevance to the United States. Those terms mean nothing. Those are antiquated foreign terms. And we said, look, this is where the evidence takes us. This is the historical evidence worldwide, including the United States. We really think we've got to keep this in because it's where, it's what, the scholars, this is where we go. And she said, okay, grudgingly. And then, you know, about 4 months later, after Bernie Sanders on one hand and Donald Trump on the other hand sort of jumped to the top of the polls in their respective parties, she got back to say, you know, you might have been onto something with that democratic socialism and fascism stuff. That was actually pretty clever.
Let me remind our listeners real quickly. You're listening to Unspun, an experiment of truth-telling. I'm your host, Doug Bennett. With us today, our guest, Robert W. McChesney, co-founder of Free Press, author of and media reformer. We are discussing his latest book, People Get Ready, The Fight Against a Jobless Economy and a Citizenless Democracy. Our call-in number is 530-337-1885, 530-337-1885. I encourage you to call in. This might be your only chance to ask Robert McChesney some important questions. I think many of us have seen this coming, and I think you're right. Fascism, it's becoming a choice between fascism and socialist democracy. FDR got this, so did Hitler in his way. And where we're headed is kind of scary, and I think you referred to the oligarchs there at Davos. I think their plan is repression. More repression, more of a fascist look, And I would love it if they would surprise me, but I see here in America the Pentagon's all set up to use military force with inside this nation, actually around the world, to suppress chaos and problems that are on the horizon. So the plan seems to be more repression. So I guess my question to you is, what makes you more hopeful that you think we can turn it around here? And you mentioned Bernie Sanders. I think some of us have hope in that. And I also, in your book, you talk to cynicism, and I guess I would be one of those that has struggled a long time and becoming more cynical. So what gives you hope?
Well, I'm glad you mentioned FDR. Who's a really central figure in our book and in Chapter 4 in particular, but really a central figure because FDR, in the 1940s, you know, the United States ended up fighting the fascists, Germany and Japan, with the Allies. And it was, in the view of FDR, it was a battle of democracy versus fascism. That's how he framed it. That's how he saw it. And he became obsessed during the war, during his third term as president, what can we do to make sure that once we win this war, that fascism never returns to the world? And FDR did not think fascism was just something that Germans got because Germans were some weird, mystical, opaque people that were incapable of self-government, or Japanese for that matter. He understood that fascism was a threat everywhere, in economies where there was massive unemployment, where the governing system was corrupt. And he was deeply concerned about fascism coming to the United States. It was what it drove him. What can we do to make sure we never allow that to come to America? And in his 1944 State of the Union address, one of the most important addresses of his career, he is, you can Google it, it's online. You actually watch the video of him giving it over the radio when he gave the address. In his State of the Union address, he said, I'm concerned about not having fascism in the United States. And this is the only way fascism emerges, he said, in countries where you have large private economic interests dominate the government. The government is seen as completely corrupt, and you have huge amounts of unemployment. That's the sort of swamp out of which the bacteria of fascism emerges, or the virus. And so he said, what do we have to do in America to make sure that never happens? And he said, we have to strengthen our democracy. That's the only solution. And what he said was we needed to expand our Constitution and add a bunch of new amendments, what he called the Second Bill of Rights, or the Economic Bill of Rights. And those amendments included the right to a job at a living wage. Not a chance to have it, but a right, guaranteed. The right to health care, the right to education, the right to housing. The right to have an economy not dominated by large economic monopolies that would distort the economy for small business and workers and also corrupt the governance because they would invariably conquer the government and take it over. He said this should be in the Constitution. He said this is what we have to do to make sure we have a governing system that's not corrupt, that serves people, in a society where fascism would never be able to take root because the democratic institutions would be on such a solid foundation. And it's interesting, this is simply, he held dear, dear to his heart. He wanted it to be the center of the post-war project in the United States, but he died shortly thereafter. It never got off the ground in America, except for the GI Bill, which grew out of that. But what did happen was that it became the basis for the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which Eleanor Roosevelt championed, which became a treaty which all the countries of the world signed, which much of it came directly out of the FDR's Second Bill of Rights. And it also, in the 1960s, became the foundation of Martin Luther King's Freedom Budget, when he presented his vision of what America should do to become a moral society and just society. And a lot of it was drawn directly from FDR. And then to bring it home, last year, when Bernie Sanders gave his speech at Georgetown University defining what did he mean by the term democratic socialism, he basically based it on FDR's Second Bill of Rights. This is what I mean. And he mentioned Martin Luther King's Freedom Budget. So this is a very long-standing tradition and understanding of how we deal with sort of crises. We strengthen our democracy we get our voter turnout rate up to 80 or 90% instead of 40 or 50%, depending on the state and the election, 30, 20% in many states and many elections. We get rid of economic inequality, reduce militarism. We do all sorts of things that put democracy on a strong footing. We get rid of all the corruption and money in politics. And I think that that is the way out to deal with the problem this time as well. Now, why am I optimistic? Well, I think someone would have to have their head in the sand not to be spectacularly optimistic right now compared to a year or two ago. You know, I spent much of the last 10 years trying to be sort of a motivational speaker for people like you, Doug, trying to say, look, it's not that bad. You know, look at historically the situation we're in. And there were glimmers of hope all along the way with activists doing interesting stuff that wasn't getting reported. But it was a tough sell because people just saw the total power of those at top, the corruption of the governing system. You know, Obama's bought off by Wall Street just like the Republicans were, and we got really wimpy reform, and our economy hasn't really gotten that much better despite all the hot air. The fundamental problems remain. But I think what we've seen in the last year has been, I'm entirely surprised by it, but it has heartened me, which is we're seeing as this country goes into the crisis years we're facing, the younger generation, people under 30, have pretty much rejected the right-wing approach, rejected the mainstream, and have gravitated overwhelmingly towards the democratic socialist approach. They want a humane, equitable, fair, decent society.
Bob, let me interrupt you there. We have a caller. He's been waiting about 5 minutes, and I think he's going to be an interesting caller. I want to bring him on the air.
Okay.
Doug, you're on the air.
Yeah, thanks, Doug. I'm sorry to interrupt you, Robert. Thank you, Doug and Robert, for today's show. I appreciate all the books you've written. I've got a few on my bookshelf, Rich Media, Poor Democracy, The Future of Media, Death and Life in American Journalism, Digital Democracy, a couple others. But love what you're talking about today. My question, and I assume you'll get to it, is when it comes to what we're all discouraged about, which is that, you know, how the media seems to keep the population unmotivated or feeling hopeless and helpless, how that might change. I also, in a sideline, wonder when we're going to have another national conference on media reform. We need one of those again, or keep doing those. And then a sideline also, as the ecology collapses, do you have any thoughts about how that's going to relate to the robotics revolution that you've talked about? And again, thank you. Thanks.
Those are terrific questions.
Yeah, great questions.
Well, I think the ecological part of the picture is a big part of the book. It's a theme running through it. And I think it is one of the issues that brings an urgency, to the matter that really can't be ignored for very long. And that's one of the reasons why the young people are overwhelmingly open to radical solutions, because they understand the stakes are a lot higher than the mainstream talks about. And so, you know, Naomi Klein wrote a wonderful book, came out last year, called This Changes Everything, about the climate crisis and what it means for politics. And I read the book, I teach it, I admire it, it's a wonderful book. And John and I, in our book, our working title before we came up with People Get Ready, just as an inside joke, was that we were going to call the book This Changes Everything Else, because we think that the loss of employment will get people's attention even more than the climate crisis, at least in the near term. There's something about being unemployed and poor and hungry that gets people's immediate attention like nothing else historically, I think for self-evident reasons. And so I was talking about my optimism. My optimism has been predicated on that young people have moved, you know, gotten involved and interested in social change, politics, represented largely by the Sanders campaign, but not exclusively, in a manner that's been much faster than I anticipated. We thought it would be happening. We had no illusions. We thought this day would be coming, and better days still. But we thought it'd be like 4, 5, 10 years down the road, perhaps. But it's happened faster than we thought, and we're delighted with it. And it, I think if anyone is at all remotely cynical or pessimistic, go travel when Bertie gets from California. Travel on his campaign with him for 3 days. Go to some of those rallies. Talk to people. And I assure you, your cynicism will be ended immediately. As for the corporate media, I couldn't agree more. I mean, corporate media, every time you think it can't get worse, it does. I don't know how they can find newer lows to get to. And part of the problem is all the longstanding biases that I've written about and others have as well. But a key part of the problem that I've talked about in my book, Death and Life of American Journalism, and other work that I've done, and John's done some of it with me, is that we don't have journalism anymore. Capitalist corporations have increasingly decided that actual reporting on events in the community and in a state and a country, real reporting, we actually look at what's going on and expose it and examine it. That costs too much money. It's not profitable. So we really don't have journalism, very little journalism left. Newsrooms look like mausoleums. They're like, torched countrysides after a war. They're largely empty and bereft of people. And that's a great crisis. We talk about it in this book. It's a crucial part of the democratic infrastructure we have to replace. Clearly, the market's not going to do it. The corporate system is failing us. One of the reasons this station exists. And so we believe a crucial campaign move is to build the structures and funding, public funding, so we have independent, uncensored, competing nonprofit news media in communities across the country. It's an issue that I'm really strongly dedicated to as being foundational to having any future to solve any of these problems. So it's a crucial part of the program. And but one of the things that's interesting and I'm delighted by, the 2 points I make. So if you make the mistake of turning on the Clinton News Network or MSDNC some night and watching their cable news, basically what you're getting is Hillary Clinton's talking points every day, masquerading as journalism as they present her view of the world. And anyone who sort of follows this is like nauseated by it. But part of the reason they do this is there's no journalism there. There's no reporters. They basically just call up or get contact with someone from the Clinton campaign. This is what we think is important. Ask Bernie about this or that, some inane point usually. And that becomes their lead story. But there's no one actually investigates any claims, does any real research. That's cost money. These corporations don't want to spend any money. It's much easier to have celebrity blowhards on the air and then sell tons of commercials. It's cheap to do. Lots of gossip. The downside of that, though, is it's pretty meaningless. I mean, the average age of these shows on MSNBC and Clinton News Network or CNN, I mean, is, depending on the show, it's like 50, 60, 70 years old. Young people aren't watching these shows for good reason. They're meaningless, and they're not interested in this trivia that so captivates the Wolf Blitzers and Rachel Maddows of the world. That sort of inside-the-beltway trivia means nothing to them, and it's irrelevant to them. And so they've lost that audience altogether, and they're never going to have it. They're talking to old people, and old people, upper-middle-class old people, the sort of people who support Hillary. And, the heartening news is that, and this, Douglas, gets back to your earlier point, that a lot of these young people are able to use social media to bypass the propaganda system and keep their sanity when they're being absolutely deluged with endless gibberish about how bad Sanders is being generated by the Clinton campaign. This is baseless and unsubstantiated.
Well, where do you see, I'm interested... And I think this is part of our caller, Doug's question. And I've had people on air with me that talk about the future may not be that bright in the fact that if we don't have some change, we're going to have serious economic collapse. And on top of that, if you put the dangers of climate change and global warming, which many people think are far more imminent than we have been led to believe. What happens to this future that you see, where technologically we are freed up in this kind of dystopian future that many of us are looking at?
Well, the problem with the dystopian future is that it envisions the day, and I'm prone to this as well, so it's not a criticism, but it's an observation that it's understandable because we sort of you look backwards and you say, oh, 1950, this is what America looked like. And 2016, this is what it looks like. And so in 2050, it could look like this, and it's no one has jobs, and you can't breathe the air, and the sea level is all the way up to Chicago, the coastline. And so, you know, California's been eliminated except for some mountaintops. You go, it's going to be horrible. It'll be the end of the world. Let's go kill ourselves. But the problem with that line of thinking is, you know, you go from 2016, you don't just push a button and end up in 2050. You go through a process. And that process determines where you're going to end up at 2050. And no one can, and the type of corruption we have now is not so you can survive. I mean, when you get 20% unemployment, and you have raping poverty, people don't say, okay, I'm going to go to sleep till 2050 and hope they figure out something by then. They rise up, they raise hell. Doesn't always have good solutions. But you don't stay on the same path. It's not like policies don't change. There will be change. The question is whether we're going to control the change, or whether it's going to be controlled by forces that are not, don't have the interests of the people foremost in their mind. But, you know, you don't just suddenly go to, you know, the end of the world ecologically and 80% unemployment, where they're just maintaining bogus elections of people like Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump. You actually have massive social upheaval in these countries, including this one, along the way. And that, what happens in that upheaval will determine where you end up. You know, we're not on some locked-in path that we have to end up where the trends say we're going, assuming there's no political activism. There's no society on Earth that has 20% unemployment that doesn't have a massive increase in political activism, including the United States, and that, or a society that has massive economic dislocation, but sort of ecological challenges we're facing with climate change right now. I mean, so if you've got to factor in the variable that has to be factored in that no one does in those gloomy prognostications, is what people do. And I think we're already seeing signs right now, people aren't just going to get their thumbs in their butts and sleep for the next 40 years. They're going to say, hey, I'm a human, I want to be part of this, I'm going to get involved. So that's the issue for us. How do we get involved? How do we make the change? The signs in the last year, Doug, are people are waking up. They aren't just playing with their cell phones, sleeping, and, you know, content to ride it out and hope the people in power sort of figure out how to solve problems.
All right, we got another caller I want to bring on. Pamela, you're on the air.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning to everybody there, and this is a wonderful show and great minds, your guest and Doug, and I'm really enjoying it. Except that my streaming stopped, so I'm calling in, so I hope I'm not redundant.
Well, what did you have a question for Bob?
I do have a question, and I was wondering how he feels about not exactly a parallel economy, especially with what he's saying about, you know, the loss of jobs, and but more of a cooperative eco-village kind of living, producing food, producing energy, its own energy, rather than trying to go up against this monolithic, oligarchical structure? That's my question.
Good question.
Excellent question. Okay. And in fact, in the conclusion of the book, we go into a lot of the really interesting stuff that's taking place in the United States, not just like in rural areas with hippie communes and stuff like that, which is fine. I'm all for hippie communes. But rather in places like Cleveland, Ohio, and Detroit, Michigan, abandoned deindustrialized cities where people are creating cooperatives. They're creating, you know, urban farming. They're creating new institutions to create an economy that serves people. And I think it's some of the most extraordinary and exciting developments. We're both big fans of it. We think that the future is being born oftentimes in places like this. But I think the way I would frame it is a little bit differently. I don't see them as like, and I don't think they are, as an alternative that basically is going to grow up on its own, independent of the dominant system, which is the evil system they're just going to not participate in. Because I think the evil system dominates everything. And I think ultimately, for those cooperatives and sort of alternative economy to survive and thrive, it has to win political victories. Because the way it survives and thrives is by getting local governments then to buy their contracts for stuff to encourage these local small businesses or cooperatives to succeed. And there's going to have to be, you know, social change so these corporations can't crush them. And I'll tell you an example of this. It's a very small example, but it's a good one. You know, there's including in California, there's, I think, roughly 3 or 4 dozen, maybe even more, 80 now, communities that are fed up with internet service provision provided by the big cartel of AT&T and the cable companies like Comcast and Verizon. And so in their communities, they set up municipally run broadband systems, which are much better, much cheaper, and everyone can have access to them in their town because they're fed up with paying super high rates to these really criminal monopolists like AT&T, Verizon, and Comcast, and the likes. And what the monopolies have done, the cartel of these huge giant companies, which are not free market companies, they're created by government licenses, they're just government authorized monopolies, and they own the government because they have so much power and so many lobbies. Well, what they've done in response to municipally owned broadband services that are nonprofit and serve everyone in a much better product, and an ideal way, the rational way to do broadband, make it a public utility that everyone can have access to. What the monopolies have done is they've gone to state governments all around the country trying to make them illegal. And they've succeeded in a number, but they've lost in a number, too. Anywhere where people have tasted what that's like, they're going to fight for them. No matter what their political views, they get politicized by this. And this is the sort of stuff that's going to happen anytime you create an alternative that threatens dominant capitalist economic interests. You're going to have a war on your hands. So I want to build this alternative economy. It's absolutely the future. But it's also a political fight at all times. And I think the people doing it in Cleveland or Detroit see that. You know, if you get successful and you don't at the same time start winning political power and changing policies and bringing people along, understand the political implications, you're not going to be prepared for the war that you are invariably going to face if you're successful.
Wow. Let me remind. Oh, you're still there, Pamela.
Yes, I see.
Yes,
thank you
ahead.
Very much. And wow, and I'll hang up now. Thank you.
Thank you, Pamela.
Bye.
Yeah, I want to remind our listeners you're listening to Unspun, an experiment in truth telling. I'm your host, Doug Bennett. Our guest is Robert W. McChesney, co-founder of Free Press, author, and a media reformer. We are discussing his latest book, People Get Ready, The Fight Against a Jobless Economy and a Citizenless Democracy. Our call-in number is 530-337-1885, 530-337-1885. You still have about another 5 minutes to call in, so I urge you to do that if you have a question for Robert McChesney.
Hey, Doug, I have a question for you.
Oh, okay.
What part of California are you based in?
We're in Northern California, just a little outside of Redding, which is, you know, it's a hub of this part of California. We're up closer to the Oregon border.
Okay, yeah, it's beautiful up there.
Yeah, it's a beautiful spot, but it's ultimately depressed, and the life has been sucked out of it by the large corporations. The big box stores eliminated almost all the mom and pops. We have a depressed forestry industry, which is not doing us any good anyway. It's been mechanized, as you say, even that. You would think jobs like that would last forever, but they don't. They're all going away. So we're very much, and I would imagine every place you've gone in the country, the not only the rural areas, but the urban areas must really be feeling this squeeze. And so in your mind, that's encouraging because they're going to stand up eventually, and I hope to see that myself.
No, I think they're standing up now. I mean, maybe in Reading it's still got a ways to go. But, you know, I think what the historical lesson and the lesson we see all around us is that when people get a sense they can change something, they get very active. And when they know they have to change something, they get extremely active. And I think that we're close to that typically, and we're seeing it all around us. Again, I would just wish everyone listening to the show, and including yourself, Doug, when the attention turns to California in about 3 or 4 weeks, these Democratic candidates, and they start campaigning around the state, I think if you want to really blow your mind positively, travel with Sanders for 3 or 4 days, or a day or two even, and talk to the people in his rallies, I mean, who are going to be overwhelmingly under the age of 30. It'll be a real boost to your morale.
You know, and I might just take you up on that, because part of what I do, of course, is to accentuate the reality of where we're headed, which is also motivational in the sense that if you don't want to go there, you need to get active. And we have another caller. Let me take this caller because I know he's pretty active in the community here and bring him up on the air. Randy, you're on the air.
Hey, good morning.
Good morning.
Hey, I wanted to pick up on what Pamela, the point Pamela just brought up. And this morning I read an article about where there's many areas in the states where living off the grid, they're outlawing that, where they're forcing you to become part of a, you know, part of the system. I just like to know if you could offer any advice or any direction on where people could possibly find doorways out of being locked into this system, becoming a cog. It seems like we're being forced to from all corners. How do we address this situation or resist it? Thank you.
Well,
thank you.
Yeah, that's a great question, and I'll give you a similar answer that I just gave Pamela. You know, when Joe Louis was the heavyweight champion of the world, he was fighting a guy named Billy Kahn, who was very quick and very fast. And they said, well, Joe Louis, think you can beat Billy Kahn because he's so quick. And he said, he can run, but he can't hide. And I think that's sort of the problem we face here. You can run, but you can't hide. And I think as we build alternative institutions, you want to be off the grid. Unfortunately, you answered the question. You can't really do it unless you politically make it possible to have space off the grid, and ultimately you plan to redo the grid. And what I mean by that is, if you're in Reading, you're in a rural area, for example, or in a city like Cleveland or Detroit, wherever you are, you have a decided stake as you're building your institutions to actually try to get people on the city council, get people in the government. Use the what seems like small levers of power you can control to funnel resources, open, make it possible to create space for alternative institutions, protect them, and take the politics seriously, because they are going to. If you are successful, they're coming after you, as we talked about, and that's going to go on. Be prepared for it, and that's part of the struggle. But I mean, eventually there's going to be a grid. It's either going to be our grid or their grid. It's not going to be they get a grid and they let us have a little piece of it that we can sort of hang on by our fingernails. So that we're not going to be able to hold on then.
Yeah, you bring up that it's an observable phenomenon. We see how whistleblowers have been treated by the Obama administration. We see repression and. Actually, I think the oligarchs, the powers that be, whoever that might be, the so-called powers that might that be, I think they're ahead of us. And as you say, be ready, because you're going to get resistance. We see it everywhere, even if it's solar energy. We see the large energy corporations coming out and pushing to make that more difficult and more costly, and at a time when we actually need the opposite response. So. I guess you're seeing some hope in the Bernie Sanders campaign, obviously. But we've been sold the hope before by Obama, and
there's no comparison between Barack Obama and Bernie Sanders. Their campaigns and their movements. Barack Obama, you know, very gifted guy, very smart guy, but he's also the number one candidate in American history for getting money from Wall Street. No Republican got as much money as Barack Obama got. He's a mainstream guy. He's a corporate guy. And he's a corporate guy who's got much nicer rhetoric than a Republican or Hillary Clinton. But he never gave any illusions that he was really fundamentally about a political revolution and actually changing the power basis of the system. Bernie Sanders has always been... You know, that's why he's so popular, one of the main reasons. You know, he doesn't hang out with rich people. He just doesn't live in a rich person's house. That's not the culture he's in. He doesn't want to have, you know, shrimp cocktail at Davos with, you know, the head of Amazon. That's just not his world. He doesn't relate to that. He's a working class person who's true to his beliefs and has a long record to show it. So he will face immense problems if he were elected, but he knows that. He's faced immense problems all along the way, but he's not trying to scam a job, cooking up rhetoric with focus groups to see what buzzwords work or anything. There's really no comparison there.
And that's hopeful. I agree with you. I think it's hopeful too. And but moving forward, so how? And I know you address this in your book, and we've only got about 3 minutes left. So how do we make this happen? How do Americans get back their power, restore democracy? How do we go about that? What do we need to do, Bum?
Well, I think, you know, you do it, not everyone does the exact same thing, but you have great callers who call in today. And what you do, you've got a community of people who really care about the future of living up there in Redding and in Northern California. You know, start organizing. You know, what I think is so exciting right now is that when you actually start talking to your neighbors, you realize that the values that all of you hold are much more commonly held than you're led to believe in the corporate media. That actually, it's the mainstream that's sort of really shrinking, and we're growing. And I think we have opportunities now to do outreach, and at the local level especially, where big money can't take over as easily, you can have one-to-one conversations with neighbors. You know, get in and get a county government, sort of get some independent voices in there, and create space for alternatives. I think this is the next stage to go at the electoral level, and then back to what Pamela and the other callers talked about. Yeah, build those co-ops, build the alternative stuff, do stuff that is considered quote unquote off the grid. But understand that, you know, you can't, if you think you can just hide from the grid, you're going to get away with it. That doesn't work that way. You've got to battle the grid, have that in your mind all the way, create the space. And eventually you're going to have to replace that grid if you want to live in a society worth living in.
And we see that. We see it in the Black Lives Matter movement. We see it in the Bill McKibben's 350.org. We see people rising up along with the Bernie Sanders. So maybe we need to get together, get on that train.
Absolutely. You started the show with the right song, and now you're ending up with those lyrics.
Okay, well, I'm going to leave it there. I want to thank you very much, Robert McChesney, for being on Unspun, an Experiment in Truth-Telling with us today.
It's my great pleasure. You've got a great audience, and let's do it again sometime, Bob.
I'd love to do that, and I think I hear our music coming up in the background here, which is our cue to get off. Yeah, there it is. So thank you once again, and keep up the great work. Good talking with you.
Okie dokie, bye-bye.
Bye-bye. You've been listening to Unspun, an Experiment in Truth-Telling. I am your host, Doug Bennett, and today our guest has been Robert W. McChesney, Gutskill Endowed Professor at the Department of Communications at the University of Illinois. So I got to turn that music down a little bit. At Urbana-Champaign, and the author or editor of 23 books and media reform advocate. The archives of this show will be online at KKRN.org/shows/unspun, along with links to his websites and his books. Next week on Unspun, we'll be talking with Peggy Rebold, local director of ministry at the First United Methodist Church in Reading and founder of our local Whole Earth and Watershed Festival. Also with us is eco-psychologist, therapist, and organic farmer Jim Collins, and we'll be honoring Mother Earth in lieu of Earth Day coming up. What is that? I think the 22nd of April. We will be talking about right relationships with our community and connections to nature. So tune in. KKRN is a community radio station supported by listeners and underwriters like yourself. Go to kkrn.org and click on the donate button to support our efforts. Next up, Tom Hartman on KKRN. Stay tuned.